Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 62 of Dominario's Judgment, a weekly Constructed Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. And today we have a very colourful episode for you, both in terms of the actual decks themselves, in terms of the variety of the decks, and possibly some colourful language too, depending on what our dogs decide to get up to during the recording.
Yeah, we are short an episode because, in part, I was moving, and the new place, Zam has decided to wreak havoc. There are neighborhood cats that she stalks from all of the windows. There are deer that if they show up in the front yard, she will hop up on the windowsill like a cat and stalk. Yeah, she's just been causing trouble, you know? So we'll see what she gets into.
Yeah, in case you hear what sounds like a dying banshee in the background, don't worry, that's just my husky. They make those sounds, or so I'm told, so nothing to worry about on that end. The show must go on. And people who have decided to support the show this week, to get the housekeeping out the way at the top here, we have Pranav, Aaron, and then two fellow podcasters and friends of the show, Stanislav from The Dive Down, and More Nothings, Apestein from Constructive Criticism, all joined us on Patreon this week, so very grateful to all of them. And you too can do the same, patreon.com/dominarius_judgment, and then you can find us at the usual places, Twitter, at dominaria_pod, and then the Discord, which is linked on the Twitter, so go there first, a fairly thriving community at this point, so good to see a lot of chatter in there. As always, and we have a lot to get to in the main segment, and it's a great time to be doing this because I realized when we had already had this scheduled that I think exactly a year ago, however many episodes that was at this point, we did an episode on the four color decks that were popular in Modern at that time, but the four color deck as we know and possibly love it at the moment had not really been discovered yet. So in that episode we went through Elementals, which was the talk of the town. We went through the creativity decks, which back then were the big debate was Venomacus versus Sarah's Emissary and so on, and a few other ones on the fringes there, some Scapeshift, Bring to Light action, but just four color, the Scourge of Modern, depending on who you ask, was a glint in the eye of the Nephilim at that stage.
Yeah, I seem to remember a weekend where everyone was debating whether Azorius Yorian or four-color Yorian was better, and we have a very clear answer these days, because I have not seen... I mean, Kurivor showed up in a deck dump maybe a month ago, but not, you know, every single week.
I still think back to that weekend where this early rough iteration of four-color Ephemerate won a Modern challenge, and the pilot was on Twitter saying this was so easy, this deck is insane, you should all pick it up. And it looked very odd on paper, but by the time we got to 2 or 3 weeks later, the deck was everywhere. It was a thing you either had to pick up and play or prepare to play against, and it felt like it very naturally settled into that role as one of the best decks in the format. And as we have covered in the past few episodes, it's almost shocking that it took us that long to get there in the first place.
Yeah, especially because, like, generic four-color had a decent pedigree leading in. Like, we knew about Ren and Six. We knew about, like, fetching Triomes. It just took people a while to put the good cards together, even though I guess all the good cards were pretty obvious.
Yeah, we already knew that Ren and Six and Omnath were good cards. We've seen them wreaking havoc in Modern together, along with Teferi, Time Raveler, as always, and then... I suppose a year or two ago it was Uro, and now it's everything else, but we already had this template for just play all the good cards, and then they printed even more good cards, which was very inconsiderate of them.
Yeah, I think some of this may have actually had to do with how powerful Cascade was during the early days of Modern, because we have seen time and time again that Living End is a slight problem for the four-color decks, and if you're just having to play against a million Living End decks over this time, I think that that might have been... a tough sell to start with, and that's why you probably saw a lot of Elementals relative to more like fair generic four color decks. And then finally, as we started to turn through the Hammer days of Modern and the Izzet days of Modern, you started to see room for a four color deck like this to show up, compete, and realize that, like, hey, it's actually pretty good against the rest of the meta, and Living End isn't actually a huge issue.
Yeah, it seemed like at first these four-color decks were mostly a response to Hammer. So Elemental, certainly, that was part of the initial hype around that. Like, this is the Kryptonite that we were looking for to combat the Hammer menace. And then it turned out that just generic four color, if you could even call it that at that stage, was maybe a more solid deck on the whole, and retained that inherent strength against Hammer that helped to keep that deck ebbing and flowing in and out of the metagame. But we should get to 2 weeks at this point of results, and we have a lot in there to cover, both in terms of there are a lot of tournaments, as always, why there are so many Magic tournaments, and also a wide range of what those are. So we have a showcase challenge on top of the usual Magic Online Fair, all the way through, you know, NRG events, SCG events, face-to-face events. There's a lot going on in there.
Yeah, it was a pretty busy couple of weeks. So I guess let's start online with the showcase challenge, which is, you know, the highest stakes event that is larger than 32 players on Magic Online. And this was won by Living End, which I believe also won a previous showcase challenge.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's this pilot, Hugo Freitas, who also was at the helm there, although I think this may be back-to-back top 8 appearances for them, but we do know that Living End did complete that back-to-back, and yeah, whenever you count this deck out, it always finds a way to come back before too long. And this was maybe the most obvious beneficiary of Modern Horizons 2, where Blue Living End was already, thanks to Sodek in large part, actually sneaking around the edges of the format in the Heliod versus Prowess days. And then when we had the full MH2 spoiler in front of us, it's, well, okay, we get Charlotte's Adrian and a better mana base, and then also like 3 or 4 different pitch spells or evoke spells that we can work our way in there too.
Yeah, I know I was not a fan of Grief recently. Having played a bit more against the deck, I think that that was maybe a like time and place that I had started playing Living End that was really good. Just, I think that there's some thought to be put into whether you play Grief and Subtlety, Grief and Endurance, or Endurance and Subtlety in any given metagame. It's like a real option, but I don't know. It's trickier than just saying that one is better than the other, even if I really like Avon Windcaller.
We have a noted Magic Online grinder, Binyu, in second place here on a fairly unremarkable Murktide list. We have this interesting threat split of 3 Channeler, 2 Legislator, and 3 Murktide Regent, along with that single Brazen Borrower as a theoretical out to whatever ails you. But I think the most notable feature of this list, the main deck, we have 2 Spell Pierce and a Spell Snare, so that much is worth noting. But in the sideboard, we have a full 3 copies of Engineered Explosives. So I think a good way to hedge against both the Resurgence of Hammer and the partial Resurgence of Rhinos at the same time.
Yeah, that and I have seen that card look fairly reasonable against Amulet Titan, like cleaning up, like if you are able to actually manage their creatures, it does clean up Amulet to slow down their draws and maybe get you to a Blood Moon if you just like land it on 1 and pop it on 2, but also hedges against Urza Saga in your non-Blood Moon game. So there's a few things that, maybe not 3 there, but like it's really easy to justify the first 1 or 2 in the current metagame, and then going up to 3 is just like, well, I would like another card against Hammer. This is a pretty darn good one.
Speaking of Amulet, this is going to be a very good set of results for Amulet and a very good set of results for Gurig with their incredibly strange build of Amulet, which is certainly worth talking about.
Yeah, so basically this list looks like they have identified that the only thing they consider a problem is it, and therefore they should build their deck so that it is the best possible against is it. That starts with Sakura Tribe Elder in the main deck, which allows you to find a bunch of basics to cast your spells through Blood Moon. But there's a lot of interesting spells that you are casting there. There's an island in the sideboard, so you can cast your Hydroid Krasis.
Yeah, so, it doesn't really matter what color of lands you have through a Blood Moon if your payoff is Inferno Titan rather than Primeval Titan. But let's back up a few steps here. So, Sakura Tribe Elder takes the place of Explore here as the kind of middling ramp spell that's meant to bridge you to the bigger stuff. And it has this interesting lineup against Ragavan in particular, where you can either threaten to block and trade with Ragavan, or you can soak up a hit and then sacrifice it to get the land while also not giving them the treasure, more importantly, and also the card in return. But then if they try to make that decision for you by burning a removal spell on your Sakura Tribe Elder, you still get to sacrifice it, you still get the benefit, and you felt like you've got a very good exchange out of that as well. So a nice way to fend off some of those Ragavan draws that can snowball and run away with the game, and also, as you mentioned, a good way to let the first forest find you the second forest in the face of a blood moon. The Hydroid Crisis thing is a really interesting angle here. So this list, this is one of several different ideas that this list is introducing. And I think some of those have more shelf life than others. I would not expect to see Inferno Titan sticking around in the mainstream for too long. But the Crisis idea is somewhat interesting. And it was picked up by Kanata en route to a top 8 with Amulet in one of these challenges himself. And he was pretty high on the Crisis idea. So the theory behind this is, against Murktide, you want enough threats that you can just keep jamming into them. But Summoner's Pact doesn't really let you do that, because if the threat that it finds gets countered, then you're on the hook for that next turn. If they have a Blood Moon, then that can maybe threaten to end the game on the spot if you don't have two forests around already. So you want more threats which line up well against counterspells, and just more threats in general. And like Crisis is one of the few things that actually does that. Crucially, it also lines up nicely against Subtlety, which otherwise is a pretty devastating card to have to fight through. And it's not perfect against Stress Down, because it's going to end a play with zero counters and die on the spot, but you do still get the cast trigger out of that as well. So the theory here is, if you can shave packs, load up on Hydroid Crisis, along with, you know, you can board in Endurance or Relic or some of these other tools, and disable some of their faster draws, while also just... between that and four copies of Cavern of Souls in the main deck, which is a choice I love, you can just kind of punch through cards like Counterspell or Archmage's Charm as well. I don't know if all of that in aggregate is enough to actually fix the matchup. I know Kanata's run was ended by Murktide. I think Gurig lost to Murktide in the hands of Binyu to end their run as well. But I think the Crisis idea is somewhat promising. And the really cool thing about it is a Jellyfish Hydra Beast, which I guess is cool in its own right, but the cool thing about it specifically is it means that a Cavern on Beast can cast Arboreal Grazer, Cultivated Colossus, and Hydroid Crisis all at once. So you're kind of bridging that gap there. And this is something that we have seen in some of these more adventurous Amulet lists, is using Cavern of Souls almost as mana fixing. So there was a list in one of these results that was, it had this very small white splash for Draenith Magistrate in the sideboard as this way to fight the Cascade decks, fight some of these other decks. And you cannot cast that card in any reasonable length of time. You just don't have that many sources. But if you have four Cavern of Souls, which is a choice that you already won when Murktide is the most popular deck in every single tournament, and that is weirdly this form of mana fixing that can be your white source or be your blue source here for Crisis. So a lot of cool stuff going on there.
Yeah, I would agree. I have experienced losses to Murktide with this deck as well, so I'm also skeptical that any of this fixes the problems, but it at least tries.
Yeah, so I think Kanata might be onto something with identifying Summoner's Pact as a weak link of sorts against Murktide. It's weird, though, given that even just the first Crisis in your deck makes a Summoner's Pact that much more threatening, because normally, if they let it resolve, if you have the Cavern to force through whatever you're finding, then you can punish them that way. But absent the Cavern, this lets a resolve pact just find a threat that gives you something back, even if they have the right answer for it. And then even if you're on the hook for the four mana next turn. So I don't think you want to move away from Pact entirely. And personally, I've had more success against Murktide just using Summoner's Pact to either set up a turn where I can present several threats implicitly, where like the first Summoner's Pact, if I have one of my four Caverns, then they're punished if they let it resolve. So they almost have to fight over that. But then that was the first free threat, which then clears away for the second one, and you just need to have a lot of copies combined of whatever your threats are to get the job done there. Also, Summoner's Pact can like fetch an Endurance, which can be a good way to like ambush stuff in combat or to protect your Titan from Unholy Heat on the big turn that you're building towards. And then sometimes like you get into spots where Dryad is the best threat, and Summoner's Pact can double up on that. So I don't know. I think even though I am open to the idea that it's a weak link there, that has not really been my experience. And also, there just is such a big drop-off between the namesake card of the deck in Primeval Titan and every other threat. So, you know, Cultivated Colossus or your Hydro Crisis, Inferno Titan, whatever your cool backup idea is almost certainly worse than Primeval Titan the vast majority of the time. And so I would be loath to move away from that. But if you really think the matchup needs radical steps to try and fix it, then this is a suitably radical step, I would argue.
It's possible you could take the mid-ground, because I think the problem is that when you draw two packs, it is almost impossible to use one as a setup piece, the way it's, like, often you'll use pack to get Azusa to, like, load up some lands, pay for a turn, and then cast your Titan, and you just can't do that after sideboarding against Blood Moon, because it's just, like, well, I'm going to concede the game in the chance that your hand is functional, and I think that if you just cut down to, like, two-ish pack, so that you never draw multiples, that's probably where you're getting a lot of these cards in and, like, hedging your threat base a little bit.
That makes sense. There's not too much else to pay attention to from the Showcase Challenge. I will, given the theme of this episode, draw your attention to the 60 card full color deck down here in 22nd place in the hands of Chinarapov. So this is reminiscent of the early four color elementals decks. We do have the Kahira the Orphan Guard as the replacement companion instead, but this is really more taking its cue from just the generic 60 card decks, which I know Alan Wu has been a champion of in the past. But this one ditches some of the generic interaction, like the counter spells and expressive iterations that you find in those lists, and this is doubling down on the Risen Reef Ephemerate angle, which is, I guess, a little easy to do when you have 60 cards and you're finding those central pieces more consistently.
Yeah, this is a deck that is really leaning into, like, there are, you know, three Furies in a 60 card deck is way more than we were seeing in any other decks. And again, this may just be a temporary reaction to an uptick in Hammer. I think the other thing that's sort of interesting about this list is that there's only three Ren and Six.
I mean, the whole reason to play 60 cards in my mind is you have turn two Ren and Six more often. And I guess this player decided I may as well keep the exact same ratio in place, or I guess that's not how it works. But either way, they decided that that they would not de-handicap themselves by drawing that card less often, which is not really a decision I can get on board with. Even in this list, which, because it only has 60 cards, has less room for some of these utility lands and fetch lands and so on, I would still want to draw that card as often as possible.
Yeah, there are two Fire and Ices before the fourth Ren and Six.
I kind of into Fire Ice, actually. This is a card which I expected to see more of in just the stock four-color decks that aren't trying to get too experimental, but we haven't actually seen it, and I'm still not quite sure why that is. I guess at this stage, there are just so many good two-drops, and that's usually the spot at the curve that is most clunked up, that, you know, another marginal two-drop is going to have a tough time getting a fair hearing, but I would expect to see that card a little bit more often.
I think that the four-color decks don't really leverage the ice half of the card well enough. It's been really impressive when it's in any spot where, like, tapping a land is a major upside. Like, even the Azorius decks were, like, you would think that it's not a huge upside, but it bridges them really well to, like, a powerful Planeswalker in the face of, like, oh, I've just time-walked my Living End opponent, and I now get to untap on a better turn, a better mana setup. This four-color deck doesn't really have that in that same kind of sense, where it's like, oh, I've time-walked my opponent, I'm just, like, I don't know, gonna play the same Omnath, that's great.
Yeah, I would expect to see it more maybe in the Ragavan list of four color, where both halves of fire and ice are good at forcing your Ragavan through, or giving it more time to connect and get the job done. I guess here in these Risen Reef lists, one of the issues those decks have had is once you get to turn three, you start popping off. But before that, you don't have that much good interaction. And in the 60 card deck, okay, you're going to draw Prismatic Ending a little bit more often, but Fire and Ice stands out as a good way to bridge that gap almost. You have something to do on turn two, which, if you can kill a Ragavan with it or kill something else with it, that's great. Otherwise, just Ice that thing, get some fraction of a time walk, whatever that amounts to, and go from there.
Yeah, and it also doesn't sort of dead-end your Risen Reef chains the same way that a Unholy Heat might. Even if Unholy Heat's a better card, maybe that's the angle that they were pushing for, because there isn't really an angle for... I guess there's two Force Negation in the sideboard, so maybe, like, being a blue card matters, but I'm a little skeptical of that.
Mm-hmm. Let's keep it moving here. So the Sunday challenge from last week, on the 24th, we have Xurk going from 9th to 1st place, winning it all here with Black-Green Yawgmoth, a deck which I know that whenever Bamzing does these write-ups on Reddit, there are always people in the comments complaining that the only time Yawgmoth gets attention is in Bamsing's write-up when it gets exactly first place in a challenge, because the deck kind of flies under the radar otherwise, but if it keeps winning challenges, then I don't know how long that will continue.
Well, there is a lot of Yawgmoth throughout the results of these weeks, but there's, like, if you look back, there's not a lot of Yawgmoth in the top eights, which sort of implies that it's putting up these, like, medium finishes and not really breaking through these days. I don't have a good reason why, because I, like, the deck's good against Hammer, it can be built to beat Amulet, and I have generally liked it against Izzet, but I, like I said, I don't really have a good reason why it wouldn't be winning more, but the fact that it isn't is concerning.
I think the what you would think is the Hammer resurgence, and I guess by extension the Affinity upsurgence of the past few weeks, would be somewhat responsible for its success, where that is the matchup that you most want to see, I think. And yet, looking at these results, Hammer has died back down from that high point a few weeks ago, and the top 32 breakdown by archetype here is 8 Izzet Murktide, 4 Black Green Yawgmoth, and 4 Living End as the 3 most popular decks. And if you think that the Izzet matchup is always close-ish, but like decent for Yawgmoth, and then Living End is one of those very good matchups, then that seems like a fine position for the deck to be in as well, especially as the deck that's meant to prey on it in whatever four color variant is popular at the moment seems to be on a downswing, which is makes the timing of this episode a little bit more inconvenient.
Yeah, well, I think that it's less that four color is on a downswing and more that it's really diversifying into a lot of weird places. Like, if you tally up all the like four color red and six decks that have been seeing results, it's not quite at the heyday of like when Elementals and four color Yorion were both like the one and two decks in the format, but it's still a lot. The difference is that like you can't just look at like, oh, there's a bunch of four color and a bunch of Elementals. It's like, well, there's a bunch of four color, and then there's also a couple of each of these decks that we're going to get to talking about that are all vaguely four color related, but trying to do something really divergent.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned 4 copies of Living End in this top 32. One of those is in 32nd at 4-3, and the other 3 are in this top 8. This was a very good tournament for Living End here.
Yeah, Living End is very powerful. It's kind of not really changing a ton. But yeah, if people ever stop respecting it, it gets really good. And looking at these sideboards, the Izzet sideboard looks okay against it, but I don't know, there's a lot of respect, but the deck just still wins. I don't really have a lot to say beyond that. It is notable that like I don't see a single main deck endurance throughout these Living End lists, which means that all the mirror matches are a different kind of horrible.
Yes, that would be a good way to, you know, if you have people who want to resolve some kind of grudge in the Magic community, which, judging by recent Twitter activity, there is no shortage of those, forcing them to play identical 60-card Living End mirrors might be a good way to do that.
Yeah, is it, like, the first person to quit, or, like, can they come to a mutual agreement that they no longer want to participate? Do they have to quit Magic if they do that?
I'm going to say yes, and as the official umpire here, I expect that ruling to stand. We should give a shout out to Anderson DeClaire here, who was the lone representative of Four Color Yorion in this top eight. And I guess as we get through 2 weeks worth of results, we have this question to encounter where ideally we want to wait for the main segment here to get into the ins and outs of the various four color builds that you can choose from. But if we think that that's a worthwhile endeavor in the first place, it's because the decks are good enough and enough of them are putting up enough results that in the course of covering 2 weeks we're just going to get to them, and so it feels weird to like skip past them without talking about why they're succeeding and some of the individual card choices there.
Yeah, so let's, I guess we can dive on into the Traverse list, because that was, I think, the big breakout story of these last 2 weeks, was kind of like Traverse was this novelty from the MOCS, and like just before it, didn't really do well. It was kind of in the wash. And then people sort of have started to figure out exactly what to, you know, what your Traverse list of four colors should look like, and how it should play. And then from there, it's kind of proven itself as I don't know if it's the right build of four color, but it's a very reasonable build of four color that is approximately as good as every other list of traditional four color.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of the people like Andrew Ellenbogen, notably, and a few others who heard continue to advocate for the stock-ish list or like the classic list of four color, mostly moving en masse to the Traverse version and picking that up. So I don't know if that's seen as a straight upgrade over the stock list at this point. I know that Eduardo Sagelote, for example, is still flying the flag for his Ragavan version, and the NRG was won by just normal-ish four color, whatever that means at this point. Maybe even old school four color with some ephemerates and some March of Otherworldly Lights and so on. But for the most part, a lot of the kind of prominent or active minds when it comes to developing four color have moved to this setup now.
Yeah, I think that the things that I missed, Jarvis actually had like a pretty good explanation of a lot of the stuff that I didn't really, doesn't immediately come to mind when you're casting Traverse, but like comes up a lot once you're playing the deck, like, oh, it's just more fetch lands for your Omnath, or more Bosejus for when you run in six against Tron or whatever, or just like, it costs one. It's easier to cast a spell that costs one than Illidomer's Call that costs two.
What I realized in my experiments with the Traverse list this week to prepare for this episode is I am not yet on the level as the Jarvises and Andrews Ellenbogen of the world. I think that if you have prior experience with four color, I think that making the switch to the Traverse version shouldn't be difficult. I don't think there's any big conceptual shift, any new heuristic that you really have to be aware of. I think it mostly kind of plays itself in that sense.
Yeah, I think the one thing that happens before the games is that while it looks like Traverse should let you cut lands, you can't. There's this big problem with Traverse only finding a basic that makes one color where, like, you'll just have hands where you have, like, Stomping Ground, Traverse, Icewing Quaddle, Ren and Six, and you're like, what am I supposed to do here? Like, these cards just aren't castable by each other. Like, you can't Traverse for a Triome early. It's just play the same number of lands you would. Like, if you look at a deck list of this deck, just, like, cut a card at basically random and add a fetch land, because that will just make your deck better. Like, this list, 2 Oath of Nissa, cut one of those, play a fetch land.
I've been a pretty big fan of Oath of Nissa in some of these other setups, like the Elementals decks, the Vivian deck, and so on. But yeah, I don't think that you can use Traverse as an excuse to play an even lower land count, which this is like the hidden secret to the four-color decks and why they're able to fit so many just random cards in there. It's not just that you have 80 cards, so there are more slots to play with. It's these decks are running a somewhat artificially low land count, which is quite heavily subsidized by cards like Ren and Six, and I think that would be one of the primary knock-on effects of, you know, if Ren and Six did get banned, it wouldn't just be they lose access to this really powerful tool that creates this advantage turn by turn and is this massive threat going long. It's also that just the whole mana base, the whole basis of the deck construction would have to be really updated to reflect that. And yeah, with the classic four color list, you already had this problem where you wanted to have these basics to power up your fetch lands, but you would still have these times where you had basic island and Illidomer's Call, or basic forest and expressive iteration, and you were really leaning hard on your abundant growths to make the math work out there.
Yeah, and also this list, like, it's cutting iteration, which is basically a way to find a bunch of lands. I guess the Anderson LeClaire's list is more of an Elementals list with Risen Reef, but I think there's a lot of ways you can get yourself into trouble and trick yourself into thinking you're playing enough lands. I guess you did mention, like, ways that change, like, how you play. You are actively trying to put Abundant Growth on a fetch land a lot of the time with this deck, because that's one of your fastest ways to get to Delirium. So just be on the lookout for that play. That's, like, the one thing that changes.
Yeah, we'll circle back to some of these specifics here in the main segment. For now, though, we can touch on an odd list of an already very odd four-color deck. One of the more exotic offshoots that we're going to cover in the main segment. This is not only Glimpse Elementals here in Ninth, this is Yurion Glimpse Elementals.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about this, because I feel like part of the reason you play Yurion is you're getting to play 12 Cascaders fairly freely, but my experience playing this deck, the Glimpse Elementals deck, is that you honestly just want to resolve one Cascade spell and kind of treat yourself like a Rhino's deck, where you're like, I'm going to Cascade once, I'm going to produce, you know, an Omnath and a Risen Reef, and hopefully that's good enough to win the game. And it often is. The second Glimpse, like, if you have any sort of board presence, I found that, like, casting the second Glimpse, even if it was for, like, a couple extra cards, you were just risking that, like, 1 out of 5, 1 out of 4 chance that you hit a bunch of garbage and, like, end up with, like, 2 Colony Garden tokens and a Risen Reef instead of good stuff.
Yeah, so if you compare even just the 60-card Glimpse Elementals deck to some of the earlier attempts at building Glimpse, those decks had, so the very early list, you had a bunch of, like, Emrakuls and Arcanum Cruelties, and you had these very all-in approaches to the deck. And then when the more mainstream lists started to become refined, you had these top-end cards like Chancellor of the Forge or Goblin Dark Dwellers to continue the chain going or make sure that the output from that first Glimpse was more reliably going to end the game. And the trade-off in moving to this elemental build of the deck is that you're able to play this much more consistent fair game. You don't have these cards like Dark Dwellers or Chancellor clunking up your hand. In return, though, the output of your Glimpse can be more anemic some of the time, and you're banking quite hard on your Glimpse revealing, ideally an Omnath, but Risen Reef sometimes isn't acceptable back up there. And the trade-off with moving to 80 cards is you just have fewer Omnaths to hit, and you have fewer Risen Reefs to hit. You also have fewer Colony Gardens and Wave Sifters to set up that initial Glimpse in the first few turns. So your Glimpse is harder to set up, and the expected output from it is a little worse. In return, though, you get access to some powerful tools. So Solitude is, I think, a better card than Fury on the whole. And if you color shifted those, you would much rather have a Solitude that could pitch for red than a Fury that could pitch for red. And so in this version, you just have both. And so you're able to play that angle much more reliably. You also, as you mentioned, the ratio of Cascaders actually works out a little better here because you get access to the full 4 Ardent Plea. And also, when you're glimpsing, you're revealing fewer outbursts and fewer glimpses. So the very few blanks in your deck off a glimpse, you have even fewer of those now. And so in that sense, the floor on your glimpses is also a little higher. But I don't know, I don't think that's a watch. I think on balance, you know, your glimpses are going to be a bit worse. It may be, though, that if you're making this trade-off in the first place of moving to the elemental approach, then this is like the natural extension of that. And that's a trade-off that you're already making, and this is just doubling down on that.
Yeah, I'd have to give it a try and see how much better or worse it felt. There's also the subtle, like, Living End style thing going on here, where often you will, let's say you draw, like, your first glimpse is countered, or you exile it to Fury, or it's, you know, suspended, and you cascade into a glimpse, and then you hit a Risen Reef, and you're just going to, like, put another glimpse into your hand a decent amount of the time. So with 3 glimpses, going up to 80 cards really reduces the odds that you kind of accidentally run out. Like, the Risen Reef thing is a realistic outcome and problem for this deck.
You do also get access to Teferi Time Raveler, which, in a world where Glimpse is now also a valid Cascade deck that you have to worry about, you know, the mirror is kind of a shit show, alongside both a Resurgent Crouching Footfalls deck, and sadly not a Resurgent Belief deck, although we'll continue working on that. You now have Glimpse, Rhinos, and Living End that you all need to worry about. And also, Teferi can be good at protecting your Glimpse from, you know, the card counterspell, among other things. On top of its combo applications, where let's say you glimpse into, you know, Omnath, 2 lands, and a Teferi of a Charlotte's Agent. Well, Teferi now lets you pick up the Charlotte's Agent or the Ardent Plea, that works as well, and use that mana to go again. So in conjunction with Omnath, recycling those glimpses back into your deck, it makes it much easier to keep going again. And this was actually a struggle that I found with the 60 card version, is that even though I had the endurance thing going, if I didn't have the second Cascade spell, that would sometimes be the choke point. Whereas between Teferi and Endurance here, that's not really the case any longer.
Yeah, also Teferi just being a bounce spell, I can imagine being a lot more relevant in this deck. The past Glimpse list, biggest issues have been, like, your opponent resolves a Chalice, you just aren't playing any cards that interact with it, and now you're stuck with the backup plan. So Teferi is a really good way to do that is it spaces out your mana better, where you're not, like... Because you're restricted from playing, like, Force of Vigor because it is not a permanent in the same way, like, that's kind of a problem for this deck, you end up in spots where, like, you can main phase Foundation Breaker something, but then they might just, like, untap and do something else. That all just doesn't end well, whereas, like, you could just, like, cast a fairy, pass, bounce the relevant thing on the turn that you're comboing. It all lines up really well.
Mm-hmm. So Sandpop, who was one of those three top eight members with Living End, did show up in the Saturday Challenge from this week with that 80 card glimpse deck, just finishing in the top 16 there. So it's fun to see them kind of jumping around the different Cascade variants in Modern. And that challenge, if you're a fan of wonky lists of Amulet Titan, this is a challenge for you.
Yeah, this is the Canister and Gurig top eight, is that correct?
Canister did top eight with this more sane approach to the Hydroid Crisis Secure Tribelder idea. Still some interesting cards on the sideboard. We got a Worldbreaker Hangout in there, a Hall of Storm Giants, which I was actually pretty impressed with back in the Lurrus Grixis Death Shadow days. But I would expect to see Canister kind of explore this take further. He notably is one of the last holdouts who favors Handmade Battlements over Slayer Stronghold, which is one of these partisan divides in the Amulet community going back years at this point. But a good starting point to work from there. But the first place list in the hands of Ricky Yardio, with a lot of O's at the end. This is almost the week one Innistrad Crimson Vow approach to the deck, where the Cultivator Colossus hype was in full force then, and it's in full force now. This deck has a full three copies of that card, which it's kind of cutting lands to make room for a 7-drop that wants you to have a lot of lands. So I don't know if that equation balances out for me, but from my strictly unbiased perspective, always fun to see Amulet having a good weekend here.
Yeah, very good weekend, very sort of week one list that is. I think this is sort of making some statements that the Izzet matchup is not going to be great, and that's okay. Unless you think Tireless Tracker is good there, which I'm skeptical
of. This is another heated debate recently. I am very much on the anti side of that, but I will let the people who care more about that have those debates in their own time. Let's get on to the Sunday challenge then, to close things out. From the online results, and this was won by Zerk on Yawgmoth. I think am I stuck in a time loop here? Did we already cover this, or did they win two challenges in this time span?
No, they just won back-to-back Sunday challenges. They changed their deck. They cut an endurance from the main deck for a Thoughtseize. There is a difference between the two lists. Don't worry.
Thank God. Beyond that, we have Gurig with their very unique approach to Amulet showing up. Once again, showing up with the Inferno Titan still in the sideboard, and then a more conventional Amulet list from Legend K. I think this is modeled off Canister's approach from the previous day here in top eight as well. And then beyond that, we have, let's see here, just
Bob 49ing up.
Yes, we'll work our way down to that. And then Roman MY on. Oh, this looks like the list we mentioned before, with the weird split of threats and also the Spell Pierce plus Spell Snare in the main deck. And then, as you alluded to, Bob 49 in seventh place with Urion and Ambitious Farmhand once again.
Yeah, Ambitious Farmhand is a card that has a modern pedigree of having shown up in a results dump before. So I'm not surprised to see it here, I guess.
Yes, often if someone's asking me how do I get into Modern, what I'll say is, if you have the resources and you're thinking about doing this long term, I would say pick a main deck that you enjoy, and then try to get some secondary option, which, if you tire of the first deck, or the metagame isn't right for that first deck, and ideally that should test different skills, flex different muscles, be good when that first deck is bad. It is hard to picture two more conceptually different decks than whatever this is officially and Belcher.
Yeah, it's kind of funny too, because Belcher had a good week the previous week in the Showcase Challenge, a top 8 and a top 16 as well. But it looks like more than one player had that approach, because Zerk, they had the previous week it was 9th with Yawgmoth and 1st with Yawgmoth. This week it was 11th and 1st, but It was 11th with Mill the previous day. So, you know, everyone's got to mix it up a little every so often.
I think my favorite part of this, these 95 cards from Bob 49 is the Sundering Titan in the sideboard, which we have seen in various Khan wish boards before, usually in Tron decks. We're getting to that 8 mana is... you're kind of cheating the system there. This way, you're just building up to 8 mana. You're making your land drops, and I guess if you expect the game to go really, really long against 4-color, then this is the way you break those open. This is how you go over the top.
Yeah, well, you see, it may have been borrowed from the previous day where a 4-color player finished in second with the Sundering Titan to traverse for. I know that there's a bit of a about Emrakul being a... gain 13 life in the mirror. I would expect Sundering Titan to be a little bit more than that.
Okay, that's hot. I'm going to have to try that at some point. Worth noting, in this Sunday challenge, among the deck lists that went 5-2 or better, so 24 of those, a full 9 of them, over a third, were Izzet Murktide, and almost no 4-color of any kind here. So for as much as there have been rumblings in the past few months about is 4-color too good, does it need to go, and I guess we'll touch on that as... part of the topic in our main segment. It really is Izzet Murktide that has stood the test of time, and which it feels like every single week, whether it's online, offline, what have you, this is the most popular deck in basically every tournament.
Yeah, most popular, and also just like putting up the most top eights, even if it's not winning the events. It's not like, oh, there's just a million Izzet Murktides in the top 32 and we just see them everywhere. It's like, no, this deck is like everywhere in every part of the results, and like the default best deck in the format.
Mm-hmm. I can confirm, after our speculation in the past few weeks, St. John's does exist. It is a real place that hosted a real live Magic tournament. But I don't know if we should finally actually get to the results of that, or leave those shrouded in mystery just to keep the bit going.
You know, I think that they are generic enough that we can skip everything except for the Esper control deck.
Okay, tell me more.
Yeah, so this appears to be approximately a Azorius control deck, but with Fatal Push, Drown in the Lock, and Kaya's Guile, and a Cling to Dust just showing up. This basically looks like the Pioneer Esper deck got shuffled into a modern Azorius deck.
Yeah, it's the kind of like Esper good cards, pile of cards that you often see at like the LGS level, where it's, you know, I know I want to play a control deck, and I know I want to do it my own way, and so here's just a bunch of stuff, and playing around all of it at the same time is impossible because, A, this is not a stock deck, B, you have 7 different cards you need to play against at any given time, and C, there's no way the mana base should or could actually support all of these at once, but we are taking some creative liberties there.
Well, if you start every single game by fetching Rafine's Tower, it all works out. Like, notably, there's no Thoughtseize. It really feels like there's no intent of casting a spell on turn one or needing to cast a spell on turn one.
Which is, you know, if you can guarantee that, then I guess that all works out. Let's get to the other live event, which actually did take place in America, no less. The NRG event in Chicago, which I feel like is a great way to bookend this segment. This is just classic 4-color versus Amulet in the finals here.
Yeah, and 4-color coming out on top, despite, you know, not being the, like, tutor for Boseiju list. It looks like is there only one Boseiju in this entire 75? Like, that's one of the more important cards. It looks like it was just good old Honest Magic taking down Amulet here.
It looks that way. I think this is a... I don't know if it's Mason Clark's exact list or inspired by that, but the notable feature there is a heavier focus on endurance, because when you're not doing any of these little sub-themes, you have more slots to play around with, and so the big statement being made here is 2 endurance in the main deck, 2 endurance in the sideboard, and so being able to go to the 4-4 copies against Living End, or even... I'm unclear exactly how good it is against the Traverse build in the Pseudo Mirror. I know Andrew Ellenbogen had some pretty strong takes about that on Twitter, but still pretty good against stuff like Shadow or Izzet Murktide. So if you just want to play straight up 4-color and you're thinking, what do I use the 79th and 80th card slots on, then I guess more endurances is a fine answer to that question.
Yeah, it's kind of like circling around where, like, you notice these like weird threat splits. Like, we went through a number of weeks where Izzet was just all in on Ledger Shredder, in part because Well, if you just play Shredder, Murktide, and Roggamon, your deck's not that weak to Endurance, so that's really good. And then people stopped playing Endurance, so you were able to add a couple Channelers back, apply a little more pressure against Amulet Titan. So there's reason to go all the way back around to Endurance from the people playing Endurance. So you got a bit of this dance going on there with what's the optimal is it list? I don't know, just sort of shuffle up these 12 cards and deal them out the day of.
Mm-hmm. And the NRG series and this area in particular is well known for being a hotbed of four color decks. You know, a lot of the better players on the circuit gravitate towards four color, and so you have Zach Dubin winning the whole event with four color. You have Robert Hayes, a name which will be familiar from, I think, the four color episode we did this time last year, as you would expect on four color elementals, all foiled out, very beautiful on camera. And then in 9th through 16th, we have five more four color decks. We have another copy of elementals in 9th. We have a classic four color blink, something labeled as four color control, which just seems to be the traverse list. Another four color blink deck, and then Shea Strassman on the Rivian version of this as well. So these events are full of four color, and if you're planning to play in them, then you should be building your deck, building your sideboard with that in mind.
Yeah, the four color control deck is actually going back even further, by the way. It has the Eternal Witness Time Warp setup.
Okay, so that was one of the footnotes that I had added to this long and sprawling list of four color variants to cover in the main segment here. I didn't think we would actually get a new data point on that, but it's good to see that one popping up again.
Yeah, that's not something I expected, but given the trend of all the other four color decks in the format, it almost makes sense, and maybe we can get into that.
Okay, so with that, let's get into the comparisons between these various lists, and I guess we'll start with just the classic approach, where if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and if it is broke, then it's, I think, broken in the good sense more than broken in the bad sense, if the consensus is any indication.
Yeah, it feels like everyone really likes to play four, like, or I guess let's rephrase this, all the good players like to play four color, and the deck wins enough to justify it, but it's not winning everything everywhere.
I don't know if they even like to play four color. I've seen a lot of comments to the effect of, I play four color because I think it is the best deck by some margin, but I don't enjoy doing it. I think the exact comment of, this is the least enjoyable best deck that I've ever felt forced to register for a tournament. A lot of stuff along those lines. So maybe like is the wrong word, but they know they should register the deck, and they follow through on it most of the time.
I think it's more they think they should register the deck, at least in this format. It's also possible that this is a factor of a split between live and online play, where this is a deck that really allows you to leverage a skill differential in a way that maybe, like, your opponent can't just, like, draw a Force of Vigor or a Chalice of the Void and wreck your day the way they could if you played Hammer or Living End. And I think that there's an appeal to playing Izzet, but at the same time, my experience with Izzet has been, like, you have to play out of your mind every single match, and that's where you get that, like, 57th percent of equity that makes the deck really good. And four color is just like, you don't have to prepare nearly as much. You just get to show up. Your cards are pretty obvious and good with what they do. And you just kind of cast them on the right spells and like play stuff on the right turn. And like, I don't know. There's a lot more like very like less specific. I don't want to say normal magic, but just like you can just play four color by virtue of being good at the game and get more of the way there than you would if you were just playing Izzet all day.
Given that Izzet is the most popular deck in almost every tournament, there are a lot of opportunities to see that contrast between the players who just pick it up because that's part of what happens when it's a popular deck versus the players who pick it up because they are like Steam Vents or Volcanic Island mains in every format and they have mastered this playstyle and they know what they're doing. It is like night and day. You know, if you're talking in abstract terms about your deck's Murktide matchup, that is a crucial caveat. It's how do I line up against the average Murktide pilot, and how do I line up against the kind of pilot that I would be scared of regardless of what they're playing, but they decided to show up with Murktide.
Yeah, that might be a topic for a different day, is like what it looks like to play each type of game with Murktide. On the four color sense, I think that there is also like this reasonable expectation that like if there is an end boss of the RCQ that you are playing, it's very likely to be someone playing four color, like very stock four color too.
Yeah. So on the four color topic, on the stock four color list, what more is there to say about them? Because I feel like that well has mostly been mined at this point. I don't know if there's much more to say other than to contrast them with these more exciting and more original offshoots that we've seen popping up recently.
Yeah, there's not a ton there. I mean, there's like the very minor, like, am I playing Traverse or not? Am I playing Raghavan or not? You know, am I playing Ephemerate or not? Like, those minor changes that have largely been tread over, you know, a million events. Generally, the answer right now is like, I don't really want a million Ephemerates against Izzet, so probably not. Raghavan is a personal decision that I don't have a great look into, and we talked about Traverse, so yeah, it's basically like, what Jund list are you playing? Except for, you aren't playing black, you're just playing even more colors.
Yeah, I think the argument for certainly like the stock four color deck with Counterspell is that Counterspell is just the best catch-all against stuff, like the glorious variety of random stuff that makes Modern what it is, and possibly one of the better cards in the mirror too, where if you can tag that Renin 6 on the play, tag that Teferi, tag that Omnath, like that is the best way to answer the most important cards, while also you know, gaining a kind of mana advantage at the same time. And so if you think that all of these other approaches are getting too cute, this might be the best way to just keep it simple and have this kind of reliable game plan against them. And this was when Classic 4 Color was doing well. This is part of why I think the Elementals version rose up as a response, because correctly or incorrectly, people diagnosed that if I can beat this deck with main deck Cavern of Souls when Counterspell is meant to be the best catch-all in the mirror, well, this is how I get to like force through my Risenry, force through my Omnath, and go over the top of them in that sense. And I don't know if that ever really held up, like if that logic was true in practice. But if I had no knowledge of the field that I had to play four color in, then it would be very tempting to just play this proven approach with these reactive cards that kind of cover all of my different bases.
That all sounds about right, and I think that maybe we'll cover Elementals a bit in a minute, but I think that one of the things that the stock list also gives you that these divergent lists don't is that, you know, I talked about how there's not like a Force of Vigor or Chalice or whatever that beats it. As soon as you start diverging from that, you start creating focal points that other decks can exploit. So like your opponent might have the Dress Down that is suddenly really good against you or whatever, and there just isn't that card against four color. So like, again, it's just this lack of exposure to really anything aside from like, I don't know, Calibrated Blast.
I think this may also, so I feel like we have more data on stock four color versus Izzet at this point than almost any other matchup in the format. And so that's kind of a double-edged sword in the sense that the Izzet players know how to beat this variant in particular. On the flip side, I think that the classic version has fewer angles to be exploited on than any of the variants do in the matchup. And so if you can reduce it to just the fundamentals where my best cards line up against your best cards, well, that exchange tends to favor the four color deck in my experience. And so if you think that, you know, let's say the Elementals version has this additional weakness to subtlety or Dress Down, for example. And so, you know, you don't want to risk running into that, or something like the Vivian version, for example. Like, I think that's a deck which sacrifices a lot in the Motai matchup to maybe claw some equity back elsewhere. If you just think, okay, I know what the best decks in Modern are, I know from my own experience and also just reams and reams of results at this point that stock four color is good against those, then I'll just play stock four color and, you know, and bank all of that.
Yeah, should we talk a bit about what stock four color is, since the Traverse list is edging in on that? And I will say, I don't think the Traverse list, one of the things that has kept it, you know, started bringing it into like the forefront of the four color debate is that moving to Traverse doesn't really give you an exploitable angle. Like, oh wow, they have Endurance. Like, it's not a huge deal when you lose your graveyard. You can't really just like relic your way out of the matchup. It's just like, okay, so maybe they fetch a land instead. So it really feels like it's just a like minor decision available on top of the stock four color list rather than a divergent plan.
I think I would push back on that a little, because I think the four color variants of every stripe are somewhat prone to flooding, and they have this issue, right, where they have a pretty low land count given what you would expect, but then also they have so many of their spell slots taken up by cantrips or cards to replace themselves or Renin 6, which is giving you this continuous flow of land, that you end up like risking flooding and risking mana screw at the same time. And I think that having the card which is meant to fudge those numbers being vulnerable to graveyard hate, like the difference between I'm using my Traverse to fetch an Omnath or a Solitude in a spot where I need it versus my Traverse is fetching me a basic that maybe doesn't even help me cast my spells, I think is pretty substantial a lot of the time.
Yes, but I think that, like, you gain back just as much by your opponent starting to get into the... It's the classic, like, your best plan against Jund with 90% of decks is not to try and Thoughtseize them issue, where it's like, once you get into this game, it's like, I'm going to Relic or Endurance my four-color opponent, you're just like, okay, I have committed to a game of exchanges. And that is exactly what they're trying to do. So for, like, every game that they might steal from you, there's another game where they just, like, have a Relic and you have an Omnath, and it's just like, oh, well, that didn't do anything.
We should touch on the Ragavan twist quickly, because this was something that was briefly popular, I want to say, like, the end of last year, early part of this year, and people have mostly moved away from it, even in these classic four-color lists. We have Eduardo, of course, who's still putting up results with it, but for the most part, that is more of an individual quirk at this point. I think that the argument usually is Ragavan helps you a lot in your bad matchup. So against some random combo deck, like a turn one Ragavan is something which can give you this lead, which you can snowball, you can defend with your one counterspell and actually move towards closing the game out. You know, you're casting your Omnath ahead of schedule, stuff like that. And then specifically against the Cascade decks, of which there are three distinct versions to care about now, a turn one Ragavan backed up by whatever is relevant in the matchup is one of your easier routes to victory. And then Ragavan threatening turn two Teferi versus turn three Teferi normally, that is a pretty massive difference. And so I think if you expect a ton of Cascade decks, then Ragavan plus whatever is maybe a decent approach. But I think there's not really much of a difference beyond that between classic four color without Ragavan and classic four color with Ragavan. It's not like you have to warp your deck massively beyond that. At most, you're playing maybe a few additional removal spells to help Ragavan across the finish line. But for the most part, if you kind of deleted the Ragavan from the deck list and presented the rest of it, you wouldn't notice that anything was amiss, really. It was just, okay, well, maybe this person likes having access to a little more removal than is standard.
Yeah, I think a lot of this also is timing. Like, there's just so much is it in the metagame that giving them a card that they could Lightning Bolt is not the best thing to do. And that's really where the Ragavan decision breaks down right now.
Yeah, I do think that Ragavan has become a lot worse in the mirror now that Unholy Heat is picking up in the Traverse list, where previously, when they only had Prismatic Ending, and even then, sometimes if you were dashing it every turn, then you could bob and weave around that given enough time. Now that you have Unholy Heat as a thing that kills a turn one Ragavan on the draw and then kills a dash Ragavan at basically any point, that plan is a lot less reliable, and those Unholy Heats are going to be somewhat overtaxed regardless, right? Like, if your opponent has a fully powered Unholy Heat, then if they're using it on Ragavan, they're not using it on Ren or Omnath or anything else. So maybe you're happy with that exchange. But those games where you just play turn one Ragavan across your fingers, I think that's even less reliable maybe than it used to be. And I don't have a sense of how good Ragavan was in the first place out of four color against Izzet, or how good it is now, you know, post Ledger Shredder and post some of these other changes.
Yeah, I just think that it generally has a fundamental problem of not being a two for one once you descend in any of these, like, interactive matchup. Because the problem is that, like, once you hit a certain density, you're no longer the deck that always has two for ones. You can actually hit hands where you're just like, I don't know, I drew two Ragavans and a Prismatic Ending, and like my opponent played an Expressive Iteration and suddenly I'm the one behind on cards. And I think that is it, the games is it wins the, like, weird, super long card advantage games represent enough a percentage of the games that Ragavan becomes a liability in enough games that it's not really adding anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's get into some of these other four-color variants. And I think the way to categorize these or to frame these discussions is in terms of changes in setup versus changes in payoff. So one of the phenomenons we've seen recently is this kind of mixing and matching of these different sub-themes. So you think back to when Elementals was very definitively an Elementals deck, right? Back in the 60-card Kahira days, and then even some of the Yorion Elementals decks that had, like, Mole Drifter and a bunch of Ephemerates and so on and so forth. Those were... That felt like almost like a separate deck in many aspects. But then what we saw was people slim down those packages and started to combine them with each other. So you saw Risen Reef just popping up in, you know, various different four-color decks, or, like, in the Vivian deck, for example, you could build that deck with a bunch of Planebound Accomplices to power out your Vivians. But once you're shaving down on that part of the combo, you still need a 3-drop to kickstart the combo with Vivian in most situations. And so you want that 3-drop to be something which can ramp you towards Vivian and replace itself, so you don't really care as much if it gets removed in response. And hey, Risen Reef is the perfect way to answer all of those questions. So I think that's an example of something which you can just kind of slice in wherever you want. I know Yeoman 5 had this Risen Reef Bring to Light deck where he still had Dryad, but you had Risen Reef as this just additional thing you could play on 3 that was weak to different things from Dryad and could also set up a turn for Bring to Light. So there's a lot of, like, mixing and matching involved here. And I would put the Traverse stuff in that list as well, where you have this Traverse variant of classic 4-color that doubles down on a lot of those angles. And then you have stuff like the Jerry Thompson deck, which is which he won his RCQ with, which Anderson Leclerc top 80 at the challenge with. And so this is essentially a proactive 4-color Elementals deck with the Traverse package as well. So it's kind of really epitomizing what I'm describing here. So I think Jerry's philosophy was, I don't like the reactive cards like Counterspell, and I don't think this is a good expressive iteration deck, but I like a lot of the Risen Reef stuff and I like the Traverse stuff, so why not put my chocolate with the peanut butter and just have it all, right? And so now my Traverse is finding the Cavern of Souls to force through my Omnath or something, or it's once I have the Risen Reef or I can find the Risen Reef, then I have this one mana way to set up my Solitude or what have you. So I think there's a lot of flexibility in here, and building these four color decks is actually pretty interesting, even if the joke feels like it's got pretty old if you're just playing against these four color decks from the other side.
Yeah, if the card that you are losing to is Solitude, you don't really feel the same difference. It starts mattering when you really start playing, like, is it, I think a lot of it's like, is it in Mirrors where you start seeing a lot of it, or when the decks start getting really combo-y. But like a lot of the stuff in the middle feels like, I don't know, like I said, if your opponent casts Solitude and that's the card that beats you, you don't really notice whether the other cards surrounding it are like Traverses or Iterations. I do really like cutting down on Counterspell. I will say that.
Yeah, that's a card which it just, you can play it in your four color deck almost regardless of what it is, but it is a little awkward on the mana and it does clash with, I mean, it clashes with Iteration to some extent, but it clashes with a lot of the other proactive cards that you want to be playing. And so Counterspell almost is a variant in its own right, even if it's easier to think of it in terms of the classic four-color deck with the generic good cards has Counterspell, and then you have the Risen Reef people over here and the Bring to Light people over here or whatever. I think it is fair to view Counterspell as its own distinct, like, subgrouping instead. But this is... So that's what I mean in terms of the setup stuff at the bottom. You can pick your fighter, essentially. You can mix and match however you like. The top-end stuff, I think you have to pick a lane. So, you know, if you're a Vivian deck, you can't also be a Bring to Light deck. Like, the space just isn't there, and your curve just becomes ridiculous. Or once you get to the top, you then have to choose what your end game is. And there's a lot of different ones you can choose between. I think there are a lot of viable options there. But I think there's more room to choose at the bottom, and then that kind of leaves an open question as to what you do at the top. I think the issue is that Risen Reef draws you into playing a bunch of somewhat questionable cards. So if you don't think that Fury is good right now, and I've seen, you know, Andrew Ellen Bogan suggest cutting the first Fury from the traverse list of the deck, then Risen Reef asking you to play, you know, 2, 3, or even 4 Furies is tugging you in the other direction. Or if you think that these Ephemerate lines are just not reliable against all of the Unholy Heats out there, well, Risen Reef really wants you to play a bunch of Ephemerates. So the approaches that really lean hard on Risen Reef, I think, are still questionable. But part of what I'm arguing here is you can be like a partial Risen Reef deck where it's just there kind of doing its thing on the sidelines, and that can be okay-ish as long as that's not your first play of the game on turn three.
I guess that also, and we'll probably get to this when we talk about Vivian, I think that one of the things that I really like with Risen Reef is Utopia Sprawl, so that you are not making your first play of Risen Reef on turn three. And again, Traverse does not mesh well with that. So it may actually be that Risen Reef is almost a top end in itself that defines what your low end card should look like.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And when I was fiddling around with those early builds of four color elementals, that was the big sticking point. It's that I want to bridge the gap to Risen Reef. I don't want to feel obliged to tap out for that without that Ephemerate shield up. But what are the cards that let me do that other than Prismatic Ending? And there just weren't really that many good options. So if you take Jerry's approach and you find a way to enable Unholy Heat in your deck, then I think that makes a lot of sense. Part of my issue with that is that if you also want to exploit Cavern of Souls, then if you have a lower land count in general and you need enough basics to support Traverse and a bunch of these other utility lands to enable Traverse or really exploit it to its full potential, then you just run out of slots very quickly and you start like cutting away at fetch lands, but those are the best lands in your deck, and if you draw when without a fetch land, it's kind of a disaster. So and then you're also prone to these hands which are like Unholy Heat, fetch land that has to do something else, and Cavern of Souls, and you just can't cast your spells in a realistic time frame. So I think that Traverse is it does place certain constraints on you which become more and more clear whenever you try to do anything too fiddly with your mana. As an example, I tried to, you know, one of my failed hybridization experiments was okay, what if I bring back the Dryad Valka stuff and use Traverse to set it up, because Traverse can find either half of this combo, and Dryad is an enchantment creature, so if I play a Dryad and it dies, I'm very, very close to Delirium. As it turns out, Traverse is asking you to play fewer lands. Dryad is putting you in exactly the opposite direction, where this is one of the structural issues with the Dryad Bring to Light stuff, is that you have to play some number of Valakas, you have to play enough mountains, which usually means a lot of triomes, to enable that, and so you both need to play a bunch more lands and a bunch more tap lands, and that's exactly the opposite of what Traverse is asking for you. So I don't know if there's a way to actually mesh that and make it coherent.
The answer may just be that you can't play Cavern of Souls in the other deck, and then in the Dryad deck, you just, like, can't play... I guess it's... That's a trickier one. I'm like, oh, well, you know, if you can't play Cavern of Souls, is there an equivalent land in the Dryad deck that you can just, like, throw away? Not really, and you can't really throw away spells either. So, yeah, I don't know if that's a solvable issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe you play some small number of Cavern of Souls in the Elemental deck. Like, the first one, I think, has a lot of value when you do have Traverse. But you have to not really count it as part of your mana base because it's not casting any of the spells you really need it to be casting sometimes in those first few turns.
There's also, like, once you start going down this road, you, like, I think that's something that's understated when you start talking about, like, Valakuts and Caverns, is that you're adding lands that have specific sequencing requirements that conflict with how Traverse's sequencing is throughout a game, where, like, you want to spend your one green mana on turn one and not, like, play a tapped land early or, like, I don't know. It's just, like, it gets really funky in terms of ordering your lands that it... you start adding a lot of those layers once you start branching out this way.
I will say one thing I noticed with the normal Traverse deck is that the hidden information, if you like, from Mishra's Bauble made some of those sequencing requirements a lot more difficult, where you could open a hand which is like land light-ish, or where like you know that you have a fetch land that's going to have to do a specific thing on turn one, and when you have a bauble which could represent basically anything. You don't really know how the hand is going to develop in the first few turns yet, and that can make those mulligan decisions or those turn one sequence decisions both more difficult in terms of solving the puzzle, and then just like abstractly more difficult in terms of you have less information, and even the you know, the perfect playing supercomputer cannot solve this problem properly.
Yeah, I think this is something that has been lost in the lore of Mishra's Bauble over the years, because this is the reason that Bauble didn't see play for basically forever. The more your deck is trying to play, like, the fifth turn of the game, the less exciting it is to use Bauble to, like, maybe fix your first play of the game. But when your deck is just all one-drops and, like, a little bit of... You have a little bit more, like, wiggle room in terms of, like, what your opening hand does, just because, like, I don't know. It's like, I'm just going to have a land and a spell I can cast. There's not really a lot of specifics, which is really why Bauble rose to prominence in Shadow, where the deck is just like a million cards that cost one. So you just like would always have plays and like, I don't know, you'd Bauble and you'd decide whether your top card is good. It's not like your hand has like a two drop and a five drop and a four drop and you've got a Bauble and you're like, I don't know if I have the lands and I don't really know like what I want to keep on top because my cards are all so different. The Traverse lists have a little bit of that going on still.
There is also just some inherent tension between Mishra's Bauble and expensive sorceries, whether like you Bauble, you draw a card which you're going to have to wait until your turn to cast, or if you're relying on Bauble to help you make your land drops. On one level, it does do that, but there are also these times where, like, let's say you have a landlight hand, you iteration into spell plus Bauble, which is a pretty good iteration when you're landlight. And then, okay, you put your spell to hand, you Bauble. The Bauble helps you hit your land drop, but it's next turn, and missing that land drop means everything else is now a turn behind schedule, which can be fatal when those spells are like Omnath or Hardcasting Solitude or stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think that you sort of alluded to this at the start, but I wanted to say it explicitly, of like, with the trick with Bauble where you like look at your top card and then you get to fetch it away and decide, when your fetch decision matters so much more in terms of what mana you're getting, having to make that decision before drawing your unknown card if you're shuffling is a really kind of big downgrade in any of your hands that are a little crunched on mana. There's, again, just a lot of like weird little ways that Bauble is problematic for this deck, even if it's really important for Traverse.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into a variant of the deck which has a lot of hefty players behind it. You have Javier Dominguez, Andrea Mengucci, and a few others championing this version. And this is the four-color Vivian deck, which when I was looking for lists to take for a spin earlier to research for this episode, I saw your name in that 5-0 deck list dump. So I know that you've been taking this for a spin as well. What were your findings with this deck?
I really liked Utopia Sprawl almost yes. More than everything else the deck was doing. I mean, I won a lot of games with the combo. It's hard to tell whether, like, I don't know, one of them was just, like, a hand where I had a Kiki Jiki sitting in my hand for a million turns and then drew a call and got to do the really cool thing where you, like, Elidamri's call for the Felidar Guardian and then it untaps your red source so that you get to cast your Kiki Jiki and, like, everything comes together and you feel like really smart about it all. But I don't really like, if those were just like two normal four color cards, I don't know if I would have lost that game. I did get matched up against, so it was very specifically like an M. Hayashi style Obosh deck, and this deck felt like it was massively ahead against the deck relative to traditional four color, and I got the kind of feel that one of the other edges that this deck has beyond Sprawl over the traditional four-color deck is that when Prismatic Ending is not good in a matchup, the traditional four-color deck is actually, like, not really good at answering permanence. So if your opponent is just, like, playing cards that are problems that Prismatic Ending is not a great exchange against, or, like, really stretching what you're doing in that sense, I would imagine that deck would struggle, and this deck just kind of has, like, okay, well, I'm just going to cast Vivian at some point, and that will kill my opponent. And that out is important when you end up in those spots. Like, maybe another good example might be, even though this matchup is, like, proven close, the four-color versus Elementals matchup, I think that this deck would smash Elementals every day of the week. Like, I don't really know what, like, I mean, I guess it's sort of an elemental pseudo-mirror, but you just have a combo and they don't.
Yeah, my experience of this deck in an admittedly small sample was I very rarely got to cleanly kill anyone with Vivian, but the various parts of the Vivian chain came up in these really funky ways. So, like, Karmic Guide actually being a pretty good use of Omnath mana, where I could Omnath, fetch, crack, play Karmic Guide, return something else, and now have, like, a well-developed board, or Ferodot Guardian actually was somewhat impressive, where there was one game where I played Omnath, played a fetch, cracked it, played Felidar Guardian to flicker my land to get the third Omnath trigger to just KO their Planeswalkers. It's like, okay, well, you can find really cool uses for this stuff, but the actual Vivian theme of the deck just didn't really come together at any point. And yeah, the big winner in my eyes was Utopia Spool. And I had several games actually where I was playing on hard mode in the sense that I just had these stupid Vivians in my hand that weren't doing anything, but I was able to win regardless because Utopia Spool, which is in the deck in part because you're trying to power out this a 6-drop in some decent number of games, Utopia Spool just enabling turn 2 Risen Reef or turn 2 Teferi or turn 3 Omnath was as good as it was in the kind of 60-card, 4-color elementals days over a year ago. So I wonder if there is a way to take that knowledge and apply it just maybe in some non-traverse 4-color elementals deck without a bunch of the clunky Vivian stuff just not really doing much for me.
Yeah, I mean, that card was chased out of the metagame by Spreading Seas, which is just non-existent these days. So, yeah, I think that we should have other lists of this deck reconsidering Utopia Sprawl, and that is more than the Vivian combo, like you said, what you should take away here. And all Psychic Karmic Guide also just, like, randomly winning games where it's just like, oh, my opponent has killed Omnath. I have a different Omnath. This is great. Or, like, I cast a Solitude a bunch of turns earlier and, like, I guess I just have another Solitude. It's not a really good card, but it was always good. It didn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, so if you are one of these maybe, like, heavy Eladami Skull, heavy Ephemerate builds of some other 4-color deck, maybe the first Karmic Guide is worth considering. And that's, like, a good takeaway from dabbling in all these different variants is you don't have to wholesale commit to any one of them, but there might be bits and pieces which inform whatever build of the other variant that you decide to settle on eventually. It did make me wonder if the 4-color Saheeli deck might be worth another look, because if the Risen Reef Felidar Guardian stuff is somewhat impressive and Utopia Sprawl is good, then I remember Sprawl being very good in the Saheeli deck, like setting up those turn 2 Saheeli, turn 3 something lines, and this way you get to play cards which are more realistically castable and do things instead of, you know, Vivian on the Hunt, which I didn't know what the other modes actually were until I got into these games where I knew I couldn't combo because having to do that would expose me to the removal spells that my deck is meant to be good against otherwise. And so it's just, well, okay, well, I have a Vivian, here's a 4-4 Rhino, and here's another 4-4 Rhino. And that was, I guess, decent, but like you kind of expect it to be when you're resolving and protecting this 6-mana Planeswalker.
Yeah, so my issue with Vivian was I always kept trying to, like, I'd click it and then read the minus. I'm like, there's not enough text on this. Because I keep expecting the Birthing Pod ability to be, like, a minus instead of a +2.
Right.
Not that it actually matters at that point. It's just very weird. But I think the problem with the Saheeli deck is that the Vivian deck has, like, we're talking about, like, oh, Karmic Guide is always pretty good. And, like, there's a Kiki Jiki that, like, might do something. There's one of each of those cards and, like, 2 Felidar Guardians. And, like, if you cast Vivian, it's going to be good on its own. The Felidar deck has to play, like, 4 Saheeli, 4 Felidar, and those are, like, it's really hard to make all those cards good on their own when you draw them. I think that the dead card issue is even more prominent in that list, so, like, you're really starting to diverge even further from the, like, normal 4-color game plan that the Vivian deck gets to play. That's my struggle when you start talking about Saheeli, Felidar stuff there.
Yeah, going back to elementals, so the issue that I flagged up before of how do I actually buy time to get to Risen Reef and then get to other things, I didn't feel like there were good answers there before, and I felt like in the 60-card versions, and some amount of this was Spreading Seas being everywhere back then, as opposed to these days where if you see Spreading Seas in a deck, that itself is remarkable and something worth commenting upon. I never felt that Utopia Sword was good back then, but I think it is maybe ripe for a return. And instead of jumping through all these hoops to have to enable like Unholy Heat or whatever, maybe this is the way you do it. Maybe you just bypass all of that and just try and jump up the curve and use Utopia Sword as a springboard for that.
Yeah, you probably still need some amount of like one mana interaction just to like, you will be on the draw against Rogavon some games, and if you, like, if they just go, like, Rogavon and you have Utopia Sprawl, I'm pretty sure they win that fight, but you are correct that it helps with some of the other concerns about, like, oh, I'm playing Traverse because I want more cards that cost one. It's like, well, what if I just made more mana? I could play more spells that cost more than one.
Mm-hmm. So that's the Vivian deck, which I like that it exists, but I don't know if I could wholeheartedly recommend it. Oh, especially when you have five or six other different four-color decks which all seem more fundamentally sound to me.
Yeah, I mean, I was winning with it. A lot of other good players have been winning with it, but I also agree that I can't really recommend it on a fundamental level, even if it's, like, winning is not the only thing that matters. When it, like, I don't know if those results are repeatable. So let's jump on into the next deck.
Yeah, so Glimpse Elementals, which I know that we've brought this up in the context of the different Cascade decks in the past, and if the comparison between Rhinos and Living End was always somewhat tenuous, and it sometimes felt like more a case of, okay, well, this weekend, you don't expect many Chalice of the Voids, and also you own, you know, the Charlotte's Agents and Force Negations and want to put them to work, which of these decks do you choose? Glimpse is, it's technically another Cascade deck, but its play patterns and its strengths and weaknesses are so divergent from the other two, which are also different enough from each other, that I think it almost makes more sense to group this as a four-color deck than to group this as a Cascade deck.
Yeah, I forget who played it and said this. It was actually Brian Koval, now that I'm thinking about it. But he was just like, it's four-color, but you have a turbo button where you just, like, get to throw out a Shardless Agent and produce a bunch of power. It's sort of like you get your Omnath turn early because of how you build your deck. I made the point earlier about how I was really unhappy with the second Glimpse in most games, honestly. Like, the first one would all, like, you're not looking for a combo kill in most games with this list. You're looking for enough to win the game, which, to be fair, is one of the weaknesses of the deck, which is, like, I know I played against, like, Calibrated Blast, and I was like, oh, I am going to struggle to actually win the game as a combo deck on this turn. I'm just used to, like, playing against Death Shadow, and just, like, Shardless Agent has produced four elementals. My opponent has no reasonable way of ever defeating that amount of card advantage. If your opponent just doesn't care about that, and is just like, I'm going to activate Goblin Charbelcher, the deck has some problems.
Yeah, I distinctly remember a match in a prelim recently from the Amulet side where I knew I had the win rolled up next turn as long as I got to survive the turn, and that did not look like a likely prospect at the beginning, but they just whiffed on like two decently sized glimpses because one of them didn't hit a Risen Reef or an Omnath, and so I got to, you know, survive what should have been a very likely winning turn from the deck just because that kind of median case of I'll spurt out a bunch of power and kill a few things and draw some cards. If that isn't enough, then I don't know if the deck can actually do enough things quickly to turn that around. And those are going to be some of your worst matchups, I think.
Yeah. I guess let's talk about like the upsides a little more. This deck is really, really good when the hate card that people are playing for Living End and Rhinos is Flusterstorm.
Yes.
That card is just a stone cold blank against every card in your deck that is not Cascade. And also, yeah. There's also this play pattern where, like, when you suspend Glimpse, Flusterstorm just doesn't stop the unsuspend. It, like, with Crashing Footfalls, there's some of the same, but, like, there's a bit more timing dependency on that. Glimpse just kind of, like, resolves, and your opponent's like, oh no, this is a giant fiasco.
Yeah, I played a team tournament this weekend, which we were fortunate enough to win, and my modern seat played the 60 card Glimpse deck, and I think he played against four Murktide decks en route to that win there, and I was shocked by how good the deck seemed at fighting through the average Murktide hand post sideboard of just like here's one threat backed up by one hard counter and one soft counter. And that felt much easier than I expected to fight through. And part of that was, as the game goes on, you have these fluster storms or like spell pierces maybe, which you kind of feel obliged to have to fight the cascade stuff and stop them from just gunning that on turn 3 or turn 4. But those cards are obsoleted so quickly as those games go on that, you know, versus your Footfalls or Living End, where those cards are almost guaranteed to be good for enough of the game to let you get a hold on it elsewhere. Against Glimpse, that's not really the case. And that's where the move towards this fair Elementals plan powered by Risen Reef and Cavern of Souls really does go a long way.
Yeah, that's very powerful. I know that also, like, you're just a deck that wants to play a million Endurances, so there's just a bunch of free wins that you pick up along the way there. Like, even if Endurance is not as good as it is usually against Izzet now in the Ledger Shredder days, like, you know, we're saying, okay, well, your deck lines up good against Izzet, lines up good against Living End. Glimpse, like, overpowers the four-color mirror a decent amount of time. Like, it sounds like we're really just describing a deck that beats all the best decks and, like, maybe loses to some fringe stuff. It's not entirely true, though, because, you know, the deck's really good against Flusterstorm. It's a lot worse when the hate card is a lock piece, where, like, if your opponent's plan is just, like, I don't know, throw out a Chalice of the Void and then just play a normal game besides that, the Elemental's game plan is fairly surmountable.
Yeah, if your Izzet Murktide opponent has, let's say, Chalice backed up by removal or something, that might almost be a better plan in some ways than loading up on the blue cards, which can be fought through quite easily. And the Endurance point, I think, is relevant, because I watch a lot of games where Endurance would threaten this ambush in combat, or just threaten to be a nuisance on their turn. And so if you went for this mid-combat Endurance or end-of-turn Endurance, they really wanted to try and fight over that, but they knew that doing so would leave them exposed to potentially a big Glimpse on your own turn. And so even if you didn't have Cavern to force the Endurance through, which also came up a decent amount, then that was a really difficult decision for the Murktide side to have to work through. So you really put them in a tough spot that way. And yeah, I think the Glimpse deck, the fact that you can't really interact as easily compared to Rhinos or Living End if you want to go there on the first few turns, that is an issue sometimes. So there will be more games where the opponent just has turn 3 to Fairy Time Raveler and you're out of luck. And your kind of watered down fair plan is not enough to fight through that. But the Glimpse deck, I think this iteration is very real, and I don't know yet if this 80 card twist on that twist is going to have enough purchase, and how different that is to the point where you need to consider that and its own unique strengths and weaknesses. But the Glimpse Elementals deck or decks, I think, are very real, and they're a ton of fun to play as well. So if you're looking for a break from the monotony of the usual Renin 6 Omnath games with four color, then I would definitely recommend taking it for a spin.
Yeah, and if you have played previous Glimpse lists and were not a fan of resolving the stack there, it is we said, this is not really a combo kill deck. It's a cast Glimpse and get some value deck. So you do have some big stacks, but it's like flashy, once a turn, manageable big stacks. It's not just like, oh my gosh, my four Omnaths all triggered five times, and there's also like 17 Chancellor of the Forges. That just doesn't happen here.
Do you have any more general thoughts on normal four-color elementals? Which I think compared to, let's say, 2 or 3 months ago, where this was the twist on four-color that was taking Modern by storm, I think now it's just one more variant and one more deck to worry about. But where do you think it stacks up compared to the others?
I think a few months ago it was winning a lot because it was the best. So I think that it has two problems right now. One is that Living End is on a slight downswing. Like, it's still good, but it's not the most important thing. And beating Living End was one of the big draws to the deck. The other is that Fury is not good right now. So, like, those are two of the big reasons to play Elementals over traditional four-color in my mind. And, like, there's just not a reason to have a million incarnations in your deck. And then from there, it's just like, I don't know, Risen Reef is... You're arguing Risen Reef versus Expressive Iteration in terms of, like, a marginal value card. Like, there's no reason to dedicate your whole deck to an engine. And that's kind of where I feel about it.
Yeah, I found myself agreeing conceptually that Fury was not good right now, and then losing to the random stuff in the format that was meant to be pushed out by Fury. So I feel like whenever a random tribal deck comes up on one of our episodes, one of us at least will chime in with, okay, this is the kind of deck which you can't play because of Fury. But if no one is playing Fury and the consensus is that Fury is bad, are those decks worth a look again? Or do you run into enough people who apparently have not got the memo and are still showing up with Furies in their deck?
Well, I think that a lot of those decks also have issues with Roggevon on turn one. Like, that was my experience with humans and all. Like, Aether Vial versus Roggevon. Again, like, we're talking about this, like, ramp spell versus Roggevon paradigm, and, like, we all know who the winner is there. Like, that's a big problem. Like, all these tribal decks also are, like, trying to not die to Hammer Time because they don't have interaction in time. They are, like, trying to not die to Amulet because, you like, also, like, Yawgmoth exists. There's enough cards that aren't Fury that are a problem. It's just the most in your face that, like, oh, exactly, Fury is just immediately lights out, game over. If you have a deck that beats Fury, or sorry, that loses to Fury but beats all that other random stuff, then yeah, like, it's probably a good time to be playing that deck. But that might be, like, the kind of thing where you have a one-weekend window where, like, oh, we get to play Enchantress this week because four colors on the downswing, so there's no prismatic ending, and no one has added Engineer Explosives back to their sideboard. And then, like, the next weekend, for an independent reason, everyone has added Explosives back to the Izzet sideboard because they want to beat Pure Steel Paladins, and, like, your Enchantress deck is suddenly dead after the, you know, one top eight it put up.
Well, one thing that's come up with a bunch of the four color lists recently is the addition of Icefang Coaddle as a card that, in theory, can be this turn two play that sets up your turn three, or it lets your otherwise slightly dodgy ephemerates, like, have a decent target, and you can set up these lines where you go, like, end of turn Ice Fang, try to ephemerate it, and then even if it dies, that's a fine exchange, and that clears the way for you to untap and then do what you wanted to do on your own turn. I do not believe anyone who says that they have achieve Death Touch with an Icefang Coaddle in this build between the Triomes and the Shocklands that you have to play, and then Cavern of Souls, which is meant to be one of the draws to the deck. Although, again, like, if you have to put a Cavern on Snake to cast the Coaddle in the first place, then now that Cavern is kind of out of commission for everything else. And then you have, like, the obligatory Baseju and so on. Like, you are not getting Death Touch, and you should not bank on getting Death Touch. But if your vision for this card is it's a thing to do, which sometimes will trade with the Ragavan, then maybe that's okay.
Yeah, I've had that issue with all the four color decks in general with Coaddle. Maybe I'm just, like, not fetching the right lands quite as aggressively, but my experience with that card has been that I only get Death Touch early if I have two of them, and, like, maybe on, like, turn eight it has Death Touch.
The issue in the ordinary four color decks is you're trying to cast all of these other two drops with their own special mana requirements at the same time. So, yeah, if you're trying to hope to cast, like, Elodan Rescall and Expensive Iteration and Counterspell all in the same game, you're not doing that with basic lands unless there are a lot of abundant growths involved. So maybe if you consciously slim down your other early color requirements, at that point you get to lean harder on Icefang Coaddle because it's actually a good card in the late game more reliably.
That makes sense, and yeah, that's like kind of a clash you're highlighting there, where, like, if Coaddle is a card that is increasing your deck's power in the late game, but, like, Risen Reef is also a card that's increasing your power if you survive to the point that you're, you know, have a bunch of mana to dump into elementals, you're just building a deck that is, like, a bunch of crappy 1/1s on turn 2 and 3 that is hoping to get to turn 7, and none of those cards are really helping you get there.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to a deck which, again, it's a little tenuous to even group this in with the other four color decks, but I think it's worth touching on in its own right because it's had a very good few weeks, and that's the 3+ color creativity decks, however you want to define them.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a deck that's really leaning on Renin 6 to make its mana work. Like, almost, you know, you talked about how the four color decks would have to rebuild if Renin 6 did, like, got banned or whatever. This deck would just, like, I don't know, you just scratch off half the deck list and be like, I have no idea what I'm doing, because I don't really know how you make this Dwarven Mind fetch mana work for, like, more than, like, mono red splash a hard evidence or whatever. Like, you could not splice together any, you know... There was a list that top-aided an event that I think had, like, the full five colors for, like, Teferi and Hardcasting Archon. Like, you are not getting anywhere close to that with your... requires controlling three mountains before you play the fourth land that's a mono red land without a red incense.
Yeah, you have these Grixis lists that are trying to get some redundancy on your cheating effect with like persist or whatever, but without red and six, the mana in those decks is somehow less reliable. So right now the favored variant is Teemer, where you have other green cards. You have Explore in the main deck, you have some Veil of Summers in the sideboard and some other stuff. But even if you were just Izzet or Jeskai splashing Renin 6, that splash is important enough because it actually makes your mana better overall, because Renin 6 is what ties the room together, lets you have that fetch land on turn 4 for Dwarven Mine, or especially with the other interaction in the deck, if you're trying to build towards a game where you get to creativity for one or even two and defend that with like a Spell Pierce or a Veil of Summer or something, you just don't have the resources to do that unless you have a way to make a land drop and ideally play a fetch land every single turn, and Ren is what ties that room together.
Pretty classic splashing for mana fixing, you know. You mentioned these mana issues with the three color decks. My opponents just always have basic Swamp Dwarven Mine as their lands, and it's always just so embarrassing when it happens. Play Ren and Six. Play as many mountains as you can. Play good mana with this deck because it really needs it.
Yeah, you mentioned in the past the move away from the Sacred Cow of Teferi, Time Raveler, and then, I guess by extension, some of these other white cards maybe, like Prismatic Ending or what have you. And I think that having Ren and Six is almost more important than any downstream decisions there. Like, if you want to play four color still, then hey, go ahead. But I like the three color approach, but I like the three colors that have Ren and Six in them. I would not endorse playing like Grixis or Jeskai or anything else there.
Yeah, and it's like you're saying three color, it's effectively like the fourth color is Hardcasting Archon, which I guess a lot of that also has to do with treasure tokens. And I will say that this is like one of the best decks at using treasure I've ever seen. Like, not even talking about the creativity, like targeting my own treasure, just like bursting your way to 5 or 8 mana comes up a lot with this deck. So I think that, like, in addition to Ren and Six, it's important to note that, like, you are really leaning into Prismari Command or attacking with the Goblin Shaman or Goblin Rogue, whatever the first token is off Fable of the Mirror Breaker. Like, those two things are another very key piece to the mana working out here.
Yeah, if you want to focus more on creativity, I would highly recommend listening to Nick Cirillo's MTG Grandcast episode, you know, coming off an RTQ win with that deck that really did a good job of explaining what are the reasons to pick up this deck over not just the other decks, but the other decks operating in a similar space, whether it's the other combo control decks, the other four color decks, and so on. Within creativity, I think that there's been this coalescing around Arcanum Cruelty as the big payoff there, and that makes a lot of sense. You see some fun options to switch up in the sideboard, so this is another possible Sundering Titan deck if you want to really put the hammer on your four-color opponents. The one other candidate for that slot I've seen is Primeval Titan. I think that has also mostly fallen out of favor, in part because of what that forces you to do with your mana base, where you're already set up to optimize Dwarven Mind, so that's a good start, but, you know, drawing Valakut is really not ideal. And then also, there are some... You kind of flip the pros and cons in terms of what your creativity actually gets you, where you're really banking on the first creativity being enough to stabilize or clean up a given board, and often you can put a Primeval Titan into play with that version of the deck and just die on the swing back, or die on their turn, because that Titan did not actually do anything, or it did. Maybe it got like one trigger immediately, but a worse Inferno Titan that you've had to jump through a bunch of hoops for is not that inspiring in the grand scheme of things. So unless the format moves to a point where having the option to just hard cast Primeval Titan is where you want to be, and so like maybe in the four color mirrors, actually, that is the swing point there. By and large, against stuff like Is It or whatever, I would much rather be on the Archon side of things.
Yeah, it's also like how, I don't know, how many Valaka triggers do you need for the Archon to be worse? Like, Archon is so good. That trigger is worth, like, you know, your Primeval Titan trigger is probably not even better than an Archon trigger. I will say that the thing that would make me want Titan over Archon is actually that Valakut is a card that is going to sit on the battlefield and be almost impossible to interact with. So, like, against a lot of these mid-range and control decks, you have to be setting up a creativity for, like, two or three to be really sure that you're good. Like, you need to have multiple Archons so that if they Solitude one, you're good, and, like, you're drawing enough stuff back after it. I could see a configuration of, like, Azorius where, like, it just happens that all of your Archons get exiled every game, whereas if you just had Valakuts, your opponent would die eventually to lands. So that's something to consider there.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Valakut, let's talk about a deck which we also have not seen that much of recently, but when we do, it's usually in the hands of the same two or three people, and that's the Bring to Light Scapeshift deck, featuring Dryad and Valakut and so on. This is the deck that I have a soft spot for, and I wanted to continue playing and, you know, moved away from after a certain point. I think this might be the time to come back to it, and I wonder if taking a cue from some of these other decks, which started as these very specific, focused 60-card decks and then broadened their horizons and became these like 80-card Yorion versions, I wonder if that might be the right approach to take here, especially given that the later desperate stages of the Bring to Light experiments also involved going over 60 cards, but not even with Yorion, just to have enough room to put enough mountains in my deck in the first place.
The old J-Way 66-card scapeshift.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes some sense. I'll also note that, like, on the opposition side, the fact that, like, 4-color is no longer clustered into, like, elementals and 4-color, which means that you're, like, always playing mirrors against Teferi with your Bring to Light deck, which is not great. If your opponents are just like, I don't know, I'm going to play, like, freaking Glimpse of Tomorrow, or I'm going to play, you know, Archon of Creativities. Like, these are decks that are largely trimming down on Teferi counts, like, zero. Like, they're, like, 25% down Teferi. That, like, makes it a lot more reasonable that, like, okay, I am reliably going to Bring to Light and go over the top with a full combo kill. My only question is whether, like, is Bring to Light a better full combo kill than Vivian? And, like, are you then just bundling yourself into the same realm of, like, I don't know, like, the same realm, but, like, you can't play Utopia Spell, which we said was the best card in the Vivian deck. Like, what is the card outside of casting Bring to Light that you like that goes with the Bring to Light stuff?
I guess Arboreal Grazer is kind of your Bring to Light at that point, but I don't know. I think that when you make that move to 80 cards, you go from not having enough room for everything that you want to suddenly having like a little bit too much room and having some slots to play with. So you can do the Risen Reef hybrid stuff that we mentioned before. You can just play like the 4/4 Omnath, which in the 60 card Bring to Light decks, or 60 something Bring to Light decks, it was often hard to actually find room for Omnath, as weird as that sounds, but now you just get to do that. So you can just do the play the good cards thing and also treat Bring to Light as another copy of your good cards on top of, you know, so it can be the Scapeshift and be that one card combo that's this unbeatable endgame, or it can be just another copy of Omnath or Solitude, or you can have a Supreme Verdict in your main deck, which we've seen a lot of the more generic 4-color lists do, and have another 3 to 4 virtual copies of that card. So I think that having Bring to Light as redundancy and less as its own thing is a really nice angle. Also, when you are at 80 cards, you can have these more situational one-offs. You can have the Valky, right? That, you know, Bring to Light for Valky on turn 5 was a, or turn 5 Omnath into Bring to Light for Valky was a really threatening line from those decks. And now you just, I guess you draw Bring to Light less often, but crucially, on the flip side, you draw the Valky less often, or you draw the one-off which you don't really want to draw, but you want to have access to going long, which also includes Scapeshift a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I would also argue that, like, drawing the second Bring to Light less is pretty important. The, like, 60-card Bring to Light list, I think, had a lot of hands where you without a rant spell, struggled with, like, I have two Bring to Lights. The first one is going to kill them. The second one is a dead card. And, like, they have conspired to make it harder for me to even cast the first one in a reasonable way.
Yeah, to answer your question, I do think that Bring to Light is definitely a better endgame by itself than Vivian, which requires other things, and also just, I think costing 5 versus costing 6 is a really big deal. If Vivian costs 5, I would be all about it, because those big Omnath turns, or just going Risen Reef into Vivian and then having that go off like that, that would be a lot easier to stitch together. As it is, it feels like you have really accomplished something if you get to put Vivian on the stack, regardless of what that actually leads to on the back end.
Yeah, that's fair that it is certainly, like, the Valky setup is more deployable for sure than just, like, I don't know, whatever Vivian is attempting to do as a 6-mana planeswalker.
Yeah, so I think, if anything, one thing that was an issue before was in the Lura stays, like, the Shadow decks got to the point where they were so efficient that the clunkiness of some of the Bring to Light stuff was really exposed. Now the Shadow decks are, like, they're a little clodgier, like, they have Ledger Shredder, they don't have the Lurrus endgame, and ditto for the Murktide decks, right? They're going a little bit higher, and if those decks are slowing down and becoming a little less streamlined, then that creates a bit of an opening for Bring to Light to come back in, I think. So I'd be interested in trying this build again. We did mention Time Warp, which I was going to mention in passing as a passing fad that people have moved away from, but not everyone, it seems. We did see that one copy that you mentioned in the NRG top 16 list.
Yeah, so I think that this is just sort of like trying to make your deck a combo 4-color deck, which has been the broad, like, thing that people are trying to do, without giving up too much. I mean, this was always what the Time Warps are trying to do in the first place, right?
Yeah, like, in the Mystic Sanctuary days, then, the card Mystic Sanctuary made that a lot more tenable, because you could recur the same Time Warp over and over again and generate this continuous advantage that way. And also, with Ren and Six in the mix, in your 60-card deck back then, it was much easier to race towards this endgame where, you know, you go from Ren and Six with 5 loyalty on turn 4 to, oh wait, suddenly I'm taking every remaining turn for the rest of the game. That's just not really as possible now, and, like, Time Warp really wants you to have a way to, an advantage that already exists to press with that extra turn. And generally, if you're curving, like, Omnath into a 5-drop, or you have a surviving Ren on turn 5 and a bunch of mana, like, those are already winning positions. It almost doesn't matter as much what your 5-drop is at that point, and you would much rather it be something which is also good from behind, which Time Warp really is not.
Yeah, the Ren and Six emblem dream is really a dream. Like, it's not... You're going to win almost every game that Ren and Six activates that many times, so that's not really, like, an endgame that you should plan for. It's really just, like, the Eternal Witness Ephemerate loops, and then this also goes back to the classic, well, Counterspell is just as good as a Time Warp in those spots, right? So, it's a good thought to try and be a combo deck, but it's a little bit of overkill because you just have a lot of the same kind of endgame locked up most of the time anyway.
That was the other thing too, is back when Eternal Witness plus Ephemerate was all the rage, this was one way to actually lock up the game once you had those loops going. And now both Eternal Witness and Ephemerate are less popular, and so there's, you know, Time Warp almost becomes this answer in search of a question at that stage.
Yeah, that is a very good way to put it, is, you know, and maybe this is also, like, is Time Warp stepping on the toes of, like, Emrakul the Promised End, like, what, like, you know, there, you can combo kill by taking all the turns, or you can just combo kill by casting a single card that kills them on the spot.
Mm-hmm. The final option here, which I have a lot more time for, and which I think is maybe the most promising wild card in this whole discussion, is Brawlback. This is a card which CFT Sock, who is one of the most fascinating deck builders to just observe in any format, really. This was something that they have really been drawn to and tried to make work consistently over time. And this is another thing which, if you look back at those early attempts, those were very all in on that theme or that card. And so there was a lot of, pitching Showdown of the Skulls to Fury so I can brought back my Fury and my Fetch Land at the same time, or cast my Showdown of the Skulls, and when that pops off for the third chapter, I now get to brought back that. And you can really dream big with this card if you want to. But I think this also fits into that bucket I talked about of being this somewhat flexible setup card where you could combine this with a bunch of these other approaches. For example, I know that Hogpog, I think inspired by CFT Sock, was playing Brawlback as a setup card for Bring to Light, which is a really natural curve. If, you know, Brawlback with two fetch lands is setting up this Bring to Light on turn three, that's a way to ramp that card out ahead of schedule. Or if you do have more faith in Fury than a lot of people do, then this is still a good way to do that. Or if your Traverse deck has a bunch of Mishra's Baubles, well, that's a great card to make sure that you're Brawlbacking for additional value. So I think there's a lot of ways to set this card up in a way that it's very promising, and just the natural curve of like fetch land on one, fetch land on two, Brawlback them both. Now I have, you know, Omnath mana into fetch land on turn three. That's great. Or you can do the abundant growth trick where you growth your fetch land and sacrifice it, and now you can Brawlback both of those. There's a lot of ways to stitch all of that together, and I think that that might be the next kind of a step forward if you want to look at that. Your dress down as well comes to mind. Like you find all these interactions when you go looking for them.
Yeah, the Bring to Light one is actually super interesting to me because that deck is already incentivized to up its land count. And some of that is just like playing the mountains for your scape shift or whatever. But once you go down that road and like, I just want more lands to hit land drops, Brawlback starts looking really good because you're just going to naturally play more fetch lands and have more spots where you get the double fetch land, double rampant growth Brawlback, and then have something to really do with it in, you know, Bring to Light for scape shift.
I think also when the way that you go over the top in the four color mirrors these days is either A, sick the first Omnath and run away with that advantage, or B, to race up to Emrakul the Promised End, Brawlback is basically the best way to do either of those much earlier than you could otherwise. So especially in your Traverse deck, where that is one of the comparative advantages that version has, is that your tutor for Emrakul is cheaper because it's Traverse instead of Aladamri's Call, and the Emrakul itself is cheaper. And so that mid-game line of Traverse for Emrakul and cast it is a lot more reasonable. Brawlback really powers that up even further, where now, you know, you can easily have like 7 mana or so on turn 5 and like have the Emrakul ready to go that early, which is pretty scary.
Yes and no. I don't know. There's this kind of weird dynamic with Emrakul where the fastest Emrakuls are often less concerning because it's harder for your opponent to deplete every single resource you own on the extra turn. Like, the scary Emrakuls, I think, are almost the ones that happen around like turn 8 where it's like, oh, I have 3 cards left. They're going to make me discard all of them. And then I have nothing and they have a 13-13. Whereas, like, the second extra turn, like, I don't know, it's harder to Mindslaver is worse when your opponent can't do things in the first place.
I think that's less true because of how the four-color decks are constructed, where, you know, the cards which are normally at the top of your curve, except for the one Emrakul itself, can all be leveraged for free if you want to. Like, if you need to break the emergency glass, then yeah, you can pitch cast the Solitude, you can pitch cast your Fury, and so on. And so I think you, even like an early mid-game Emrakul, you get into spots where it's like, okay, I pitch your Solitude for no value, I waste your Eladamri's Call to find another pitch spell, which I can then cast pitching another thing, and I even though you don't have that many resources, I find a way to like one with nothing you, despite all of that. Like I can find a way to solve that puzzle.
It's kind of weird that this sounds like it's pointing towards the Traverse decks being worse against Emrakul, despite being a better Emrakul deck themselves, because, like, you are traversing, like, it's easier to get stuck with a Traverse in your hand that your opponent gets to be the one to use effectively there.
That's a funny thought, and then, yeah, even if that Traverse is online, sometimes you can leverage that against them, where you Traverse for their Mendic Endurance and Endurance them, and now even on the extra turn, you don't really care what they have going on because their Traverses aren't threatening anymore. They can't cast their Emrakul even if they do find it. So the things that make them better at casting their own Emrakul. If they get Emrakul first, it's easy to flip that script around back on them, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of that is a kind of weird dynamic that I have not played the mirror yet. So thinking about it now, it just brings back mad memories. I don't know how much of the Emrakul standard you played, but I played more than enough.
Well, there were almost too many Emrakul standards, right? Where you had its debut at Eldritch Moon, and then it just like stuck around for a whole another few months past that for some reason.
Yeah, and you know, they thought it would get better with rotation because I don't know. I don't have a good reason. They printed Aetherworks Marvel. That ended well for everyone.
Yeah, see, I'm not quite sure why we were allowed to Marvel into Emrakul or actually Marvel into anything. I think that I'm not sure how that one slipped through the cracks there.
You know, the Demon of Dark Schemes Marvel decks were always really cute. So, you know, maybe if it was just those and not Ulamog Emrakul, we'd be saying a different thing about that card.
Maybe. Anyway, on that note, any closing thoughts on the sensible four-color decks before we get into our nonsense of the week here?
No, I just think that it's... this is just kind of like this idea of, like, you have these thoughts about, like, four-color is bad against XYZ, and I think that with, like, Izzet, we've noticed that, like, a lot of very small changes can be made to make Izzet good against everything. The four-color adaptations are a lot more drastic, but they seem to almost always exist in terms of being able to adjust the deck, aside from, like, cutting Ren and Six. Basically, that's where everything revolves around.
Yeah, I think if we woke up tomorrow and Ren and Six was banned, which is one of the solutions that some people have mooted to the four-color menace, then a lot of these decks would instantly wither on the vine. The Glimpse deck, which would play Ren and Six if it could, but unfortunately is prevented from doing that, that deck would carry forward. And some of these other decks, I think, would find a way to adapt, but conventional four color as it stands right now leans so heavily on that card. And like, this is the one virtue to 60 card four color, right? You lose Yorion, but you draw Ren and Six more consistently on turn two. And so I think that, you know, there's almost a concern that if you, let's say you banned Yorion, that was your solution to that problem, regardless of whether you think it's necessary, then people would just move back to 60 card four color and be fine. Whereas if you banned Ren and Six, then that would cause this fundamental shift in how all of these decks have to be constructed and maybe leave the format in a better place overall.
I don't know. I think that just might lead to Azorius becoming the deck of choice, because if you don't... So like, the reason that Azorius doesn't see a lot of play is because the four color matchup... Well, one of the major reasons is that like, the four color matchup is fundamentally unsound. Like, The decks are operating on a similar time frame, but their entire deck is 2-for-1s and yours isn't. But if you cut Ren and Six, the Azorius deck is now just like a bigger deck with like Teferi that is never getting undercut by the four color deck. And like, it just becomes like, okay, well, Azorius is better against basically everything else anyways. So everyone would just play that instead. And we'd suddenly have like, it would shake things up for sure. Like, you know, Izzet and Cascade decks would have a worse time because those, like, the Cascade decks are definitely better against four color than they are against Azorius, and like, the Azorius decks can be built to really, you know, make Izzet regret playing against it. So I think that there'd be a weird downstream effect that we aren't quite sure of yet, but I think that right now, I like how four color has this more balanced set of matchups there. Like, you know, we got a lot of questions about, like, what, you know, how do you beat Cascade? How do you beat X, Y, and Z? It's just like, I don't know, you get to change like 20 cards in your deck on any given weekend and still be called four color. So like, you can, the deck finds answers.
Yeah, there was a neat blue white deck in, I think, the NRG that was using Narset with Day's Undoing to try to Splinter Twin the four color decks. And if they didn't feel the need to go to such desperate straits as that, then I think this might be like a monkey's paw situation where, okay, you don't have to play against four color anymore. You now have to play against blue white control that has lost the one main thing keeping it in check. And maybe there's a less shuffling involved, so you don't have to sit through as much of that. But the actual gameplay experience of playing against four color might, or playing against blue white, might actually be more frustrating by some metrics. But yeah, it's also like, you look at this episode, we've got through how many different pretty distinct variants on four color. I don't know if there's another macro archetype in the format that has that much variety to it. Like, you can tinker around with your Izzet Murktide deck, right? You can play Ledger Shredder over Dragon's Rage Channeler, and that's like the big new innovation. But you don't have like six different variants of Murktide waiting in the wings to cycle through in any given week.
Yeah, I think the only time we've seen something like this recently is when we've had like 8 million Urza Saga decks, which like are not quite the same thing. I think that those decks are a lot more diverse than the four color decks, to the point that it's really weird to lump like Amulet Titan in with Hammer Time or whatever.
Yeah, and so I get why in broad terms the four color experience from the other side is frustrating for some people. Or just from the four color side, right? Like the experience of having to speed run through your shuffling every turn so that you don't go to time in the four color mirror. Like, no one really enjoys that unless you have some weird sadistic streak to you. But in terms of like the deck building decisions, I think there's actually a lot of interesting stuff going on there, more so than actually any other archetype in the format right now.
Yeah. Do you want to cover some of those more? You know, we've talked about more extreme four color decks. What about the more extreme four-color decks in Nonsense of the Week?
Yes. So, we mentioned Time Warp really needing you to have stuff on board to leverage with it. And one of the best things you can do with an extra turn is activate a Planeswalker. So, with this deck, you have the four Renin 6, you have the four Teferi. Okay, seen all of that before. But we also have three Tamiyo Collector of Tales and two Tamiyo Compliated Sage. So, I don't know if it's worth reciting all of the text on this one, not least because there is a whole lot of it, which I guess bodes well for its possible success. But with it, yeah, this lets you can play Tamiyo minus to make a copy of your Renin 6, or actually, so if you play it for 4 mana, you pay the Phyrexian cost, it starts with 3 loyalty, so you get to make a Renin 6 or trade it in for a Teferi Time Raveler, and then I guess if you get to untap with your fake Renin 6 and your Tamiyo, then your Time Orb actually is getting you a lot of stuff at that point. But in general, you have enough stuff to use with your 4 Time Orb and your 3 copies of Savor the Moment, which it's kind of a tough one to justify casting in general, but this is also a Fires of Invention deck, so you get the classic combo of Fires do something, untap, play another spell, and play Savor the Moment off of Fires, and also not need to care about your mana being tied up now. And when you have Fires just basically making the entire mana system a complete joke, well, that frees you up to use your mana in other ways. So we have Beseju and Otobara, which you can spend your mana on, and those are both great cards to recur with your Renin 6. And then there's the usual gamut of other stuff you can do at the same time there. So I guess if you really insist on playing Time Warp, this is the way to do it.
Yeah, it also strikes me how little white there is in this list. Like, there's not even Prismatic Ending. It's just kind of splashing for Omnath and Teferi. So it's the loosest definition of four color that a four color deck could probably have.
Yeah, I guess Fires of Invention and Prismatic Ending is not really a combo, as it turns out.
Yeah, I mean, you're allowed to pay mana for a spell under Fires of Invention, right? You don't get the benefit of not paying mana for the spell.
Yeah, so you get to ignore the card that you spent 4 mana and a lot of other deck building costs on, if it comes to that. But moving on from that, usually when we talk about tribal decks in a four color context, we're thinking just about elementals, and Risen Reef has had one hell of a year. But there's also, straight from Japan, which is usually the place where this kind of thing comes from, we have four color snakes.
Yeah, just proof that any single card with Omnath is good enough. This one is a old classic with Sosuke Summons. This is a tuna green sorcery from Betrayers of Kamigawa. It makes 2 snake warrior tokens, and it's like whenever a non-token snake enters the battlefield under your control, return it to your hand.
Yeah, so there's not even any way to cheat that system. We're not like there's no kind of overchase Daredevil stuff where we're discarding this and then getting it back for free or converting it into a resource in any other way. We're casting Sasuke summons, and then we're casting it again, and then we're casting it again, and we're hoping that's going to be enough at the rate of 3 mana for 2/1s at any given time to overwhelm the opponent, which I'm not optimistic about, but I appreciate the effort that goes into this.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of weird snakes. So, like, you know, we know about Icewing Quaddle, that's a snake. Coiling Oracle is a snake in the sense that it's, like, a, you know, it's really weird because it's, like, Quaddle is, like, a snake, and Coiling Oracle is, like, a person snake, but it's still a snake. This is a whole thing if you look at the fact that, like, the entire set of Amonkhet has snake people that aren't snakes. Very weird stuff going on there. Lannis, Cryptozoologist, showing up here. Not really a combo with Sasuke summons because, you know, it doesn't trigger off token creatures entering the battlefield. But at the same time, it is yet another snake, so it is a combo with Sasuke summons. And I'm a big fan of the one Shigeki Jukai Visionary showing up. This is the 1 in a green, 1/3 snake from Kamigawa Neon Dynasty. And you can pay 1 in a green, tap it, and return it to your hand. And you, like, impulse for a land, bin the other cards that you didn't put into play. And then it's got this giant, you know, XX green-green regrowth X spells. I don't think this deck even has any of the, like, super cool limited infinite loops with the card, but I do appreciate it showing up because it, like, is one of those weird cards that's imprinted in the last year that just has, like, way too much text, and, like, it deserves to be played for how much text they have wasted on the card.
Yeah, but between Coiling Oracle and Icewing Quaddle and the Lannis as well, you would think this would be a full-on Ephemerate deck. Like, those are all very good things to pair with Ephemerate. Only 2 copies here, so we're just hoping to get that one at some point, I suppose. Though this is not a Yorion deck, so I guess that does come up more consistently. And Sasuke Summons is not the only Snake Tribal payoff we have going on here. We have one copy of Sashira the Anointed. So this is 6 mana for a 3/4. This is the kind of stats that you got back in 2004. Other snakes you control get +2/+2, and whenever a snake you control deals combat damage to a player, you may draw a card. And so you might think, oh, this is the thing that I Eladamri's Call or Traverse for once I have all of my snakes lined up. No, none of that going on here. We're just hoping to draw this one naturally. But when we do, and when we resolve it, how often is this a better use of 6 mana than a Vivian, do you reckon?
I think not often, but once you're making 6 mana with Omnath, you can cast probably anything and win the game. So if it's Sashira, you get style points, which don't really count for match points, but they do count for something.
Yeah, I do respect that this deck has the full 4 main deck force negation, because we have 9 Simic snakes in the deck to join our 4 Omnath, 4 Teferi, and so on. So we actually do have a lot of just excess blue cards left over here, and this is the rare 4-color deck with no companion, because we're 60 cards, so no Yorion. We can't play Gigantha in here, and there's no Gahira going on, because Snake is one of the creature types that is not on Gahira's exhaustive list of random stuff that it looks for in Ikoria.
Yeah, and you know, when you have, you know, Sasuke summons, you can't add another 20 cards to your deck to play Yorion. You're playing these cards to draw them. It's basically cheating to build a Yorion deck with, like, a bunch of fun of one-ofs. You have to play 60 cards if you're going down this lane.
Yeah, so there are some 4-color decks in this episode which I would wholeheartedly endorse, some which I'm curious about, and then there's this one which I would not even half-heartedly endorse, but I would love to get to the point where I could endorse this, because this looks like a hell of a fun time.
Yeah, I mean, the endorsement is more like, I would like to keep seeing this deck list over the next few weeks without posting the same image over and over. So it's only really, it's not for your own good, it's just for everyone else's benefit.
Yes. So with all of that, we will get you out of here. I am on Twitter at Dom and Javier. He's on Twitter at ARMLX. The podcast is on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominaria_judgment. You can find us and many other people. You can be part of the notorious throng on Discord. You can find the link on the podcast Twitter account. And you can find our columns at SCG and TCG Player respectively. And Ari is doing good work over there recapping the modern metagame in broad sprays, and also getting very deep in the weeds on specific decks if you're looking for deck lists and cyborg guys there.
Yeah, and Dom, you have been covering a lot of, you know, the latest hot tech week to week, a lot of Pioneer as well. So that's a great place to stop in there if you are interested in that format for your RCQs. I know I have one of those coming up that's modern. I have not quite picked up on what I'm going to be doing if I show up to a Pioneer one of those, but I'm currently sitting around trying to figure out which modern deck I want to show up for a paper tournament with, which is great.
Absolutely, yes. So hopefully this episode, if you're working through those same questions yourself, this will help you on the road to that. If you have any other questions unrelated to that, then you can, of course, hit us up in the Discord and we will get back to those. And we will be back with a topic of some description, not quite sure yet, next week. But until then, take care, everyone.